Well, good morning and welcome to The Bridge and to week two of our series, Love Out Loud. We're in a series where we thought, looking at the month of February being the love month, we wanted to talk about that word love, a word that we practically use every day of our lives. We want to talk about that word a little bit and how it might apply to our lives and how we might can learn to love out loud, to make love like a defining characteristic of our lives. And if you weren't here last week and you'd like to catch up, you can find that message in two places, either on our website, that's the video format. You can go to thebridge.me/messages and you can find the message there, or on our podcast. So you just search podcast, The Bridge Fellowship, you will find it there. So if you want to hear those catch up, go there. They're awaiting your arrival. But last week, just to kind of recap a little bit, last week we started off and we posed this question: how would you complete this sentence? And here was a sentence: my number one goal in life is. How would you complete that? What word or phrase would you put in there? My number one goal in life is what? And we said the reason this is so important is because the answer to that, it affects a lot of things in our life. It affects every relationship in our life. It affects every decision that we make. We know, man, my most important goal, what I'm really trying to accomplish in life is this. That really dictates a lot about our lives. And we said that for those of us who are Christ followers, those of us who are Jesus followers, that the Apostle Paul in the book of Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, he gives us an answer for what our life's number one goal should be. And here's what he said. In 1 Corinthians 14:1, he said, let love be your highest goal. That if you're a Christ follower, love needs to be the standard. Love needs to be that mark that we're shooting for. Love needs to be the defining characteristic of our life. That love is our highest goal. And the reason is kind of the bottom line of the series is that in order for us to love, well, if we don't love well, we won't live well. If we don't love well, and really the prescription for living well is learning how to love well. And I don't know of anyone that's not interested in living well. I've never talked to anybody that said, nah, I really don't want to live well at all. In fact, I want to live horribly. I want my life to just fall apart. Nobody ever says that, right? All of us want to live well. And I think this is true for every person in the room, regardless of where you are on your spiritual journey, that in order for you to live well, you got to learn to love well. That a prescription for a full life is that we learn to love in a full kind of way. And while I think it's true for every person in here, I know it's true. It's especially true for those of us who are Christ followers. That really the only true way to live well is as we learn to love well. And so that's what we're trying to talk about and trying to discover through this series. And today, I want you to think about this question. How do you love the VDPs in your life? Now, we all know what VIPs are, and they're typically pretty easy to love. But the VDPs, the very draining people in your life, how do you love those people? You know, they come in different forms and different temperaments. You know, some of them are just demanding people. Some of them are difficult people. Some of them are just disgruntled, pessimistic people. They're just, everything's going wrong in life. Some of them are disappointing people. In other words, they disappoint you constantly. How do you love those people? How do you love the people that just, man, it feels like they just suck the life out of you. How do you love them? In fact, some of them are people that just say the wrong things, and it seems like they say the wrong things constantly. Kind of like the guy in this video. Check this out.
I messed up. So I told her, you got a mirror, you can see what you look like in those jeans. Oh. So anyway, I don't know what to do.
You just talk to her.
And tell her what?
You tell her how you feel.
I did. I told her, I feel like you look like your mother.
Okay, no, you need to use your words. You know, romantic words.
Oh. Wait, what?
Okay, honey, you take your wife by her hands and you look her in the eyes, dead set, and you just let go. Because that's what she does to you, Todd. She makes you let go. And you say to her, "You mean everything to me. And I would let go of everything if it means that I just get to hold you for the rest of my life." And that's what you do. What are you doing?
I'm calling my wife, and you are going to tell me some pretty words to say to her. She said I have 2 minutes. What do I say? What do I say?
I'm sorry.
For what? No, you tell her that.
I'm sorry. Babe?
She's still there. I can hear her breathing. Tell her I love you and you mean everything to me and I am a fool because I don't tell you that more often.
I'm a fool for loving you and I should say that stuff more often.
You are the only reason I am half the man I am. Your love and constant support is my daily breath.
I'm half the man I am because of you. And your love is a constraint.
Constant support.
No, I'm sorry. Oh, no, your love is constantly on my breath. Daily.
You are the greatest blessing God has ever given me. And you are perfect for me.
Babe, you're the best thing God ever did for me. You're perfect. For me, you're perfect. You're not perfect. It totally worked. Babe, I'm gone in 60 seconds.
What a moron.
You were great.
I know, right?
The words you said, I heard. I had no idea.
Seriously? You had no idea that some women fall for that stuff? I'm just glad you're not that gullible.
By the way, what's for dinner?
I've messed up.
Use your words, my friend. Use those words.
Sometimes you just say the wrong things, right? And maybe that's the kind of person that you feel like, oh, they're such a drain. They're dragging the life out of me every single day. And maybe they feel like sandpaper. You love the sound of sandpaper rubbing together. Don't you love that sound? But that's the way it feels sometimes when you're dealing with these people, right? It just feels abrasive and just rubs you the wrong way. And it may not be that that person is sandpaper, but maybe your interactions always feel like sandpaper. What do you do? How do you love those people? In fact, every one of you should have in your seat there a piece of sandpaper. I want you to grab this piece of sandpaper and flip it over on the back. Because see, I know, as soon as I start talking about this person, you've had an image pop up in your mind. I mean, most of you, it came quickly of who that person is. And so on the back of this sandpaper, I'd like for you, there should be pens on the back of the seats there. I would like for you to take a pen and just write the initials of that person on the back of the sandpaper. Now, you have to be careful if that person's sitting beside you. You might need to write it in Greek or something, but write the initials of that person that's just like sandpaper, or maybe your interactions feel like sandpaper. They're just very draining people. Write their initials, and I want you to keep this with you the rest of this week, because every time, I want it to be a reminder that if we really are going to make love our highest goal, and if truly that living well is a result of loving well, then we're going to have to learn to love people that drain us. We're going to have to learn to love people that rub us the wrong way. And so I want you to keep this with you as a reminder that I need to love those people as well. Even though it might not come real easy, I need to love them as well. Last week we talked about the Apostle Paul. We looked at a passage, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And that passage is really called the love chapter of the Bible. In fact, there are a lot of weddings that will incorporate some part of this passage in their wedding ceremony. It's just beautifully written, very ornate, and a lot of people will include that, or maybe even put it in their wall in their home as a work of art. But we talked about how the Apostle Paul was writing to a group of Jesus followers there in the ancient city of Corinth, and while this it appears to be just this beautiful work of art, really, Paul was being somewhat confrontational. And he's writing to the people there in Corinth, and he's saying, listen, you can do all kinds of things to outwardly show that you're spiritual and you have this spiritual connection with God. You can do all of those things, but if you don't couple that with a God-infused kind of love for people, then all it does is come across as like you're an actor on a stage reading from a script. It's empty, it's hollow, it lacks power, and you wind up losing everything. People see through that eventually. You lose every ability to have an influence. And so he's saying you've got to love people. Now, though this passage is usually referred to in marriages or in weddings, the love he's talking about is not a romantic love. The love, and we mentioned this last week, the love he's talking about is this word agape. It is a God kind of love. It is an unyielding, a relentless, unconditional kind of love that never stops. It never gives up, regardless if it's ever acknowledged, thanked, or reciprocated. It just constantly pursues and pursues and pursues. There's no way to turn it back. It is the kind of love that God has for us, and it's the kind of love that God says that we should have for other people. It's a supernatural kind of love. And the reality is the only way that we can truly love other people in that way is for God to place that kind of love in our lives and our heart. We said last week, you can't show what you don't know. If we've never experienced it, it's hard for us to show people that kind of love. God has to place that in our heart, especially as it relates to loving the very draining people in our lives. So we're going to pick up, last week we looked at verses 1 through 3. We're going to pick up with verse 4 today. And we're going to begin reading, and Paul is going to describe to us some things, the characteristics of love. Love is certain things, love is not certain things. And all of these characteristics are really the kind of love that God has for us, but that he also says that we should have for one another. And here's what he says, 1 Corinthians 13, starting in verse 4. He says, love is patient, love is kind. And just like God is patient with us, just like Jesus is kind to us, our love should have that level of patience. Our love should have that level of kindness. And now, think about it. There are times it's really, really difficult to be patient and kind, right? Especially when it relates to loving people that are just like sandpaper to us. It's like we see sandpaper people coming and patience and kindness leave the building. It's like, I can't do it. I don't have any patience. I don't have any kindness not related to this person. But what I have found, and it may be true in your life, what I found is that my level of patience and kindness really has less to do with that person and more to do with my frantic pace. So it's like the faster I go in life, the more quickly my patience and kindness is depleted. The less margin I have, the less cushion I have around my life, the less extra room that I have in my life, the lower my level of patience is, the lower my level of kindness is. And so when it comes to people that tend to drain me, man, my reaction or my response to them is never going to be patient and kind. Yet Paul says our love should be patient and kind. Our response to those people should be patient and kind. And so what that means for us is that, and hopefully I'll give you some principles here that you can write down that maybe will help you as you deal with some of the draining people, the sandpaper people in your life. But if love is to be patient and kind, and what that means is that I need to be tactful and not just truthful. That my responses, my reactions, the way that I interact with people, I need to be tactful, not just truthful. In other words, truth is not enough. I can say the truth in the wrong way and it just never be right. It's not enough just to be truthful. It's not enough just to tell it like it is. See, sometimes, you know, we take this like a badge of honor. I just tell it like it is. I just say what's on my mind. You're never going to have to wonder about it. I'm just going to tell you like it is. Well, sometimes telling it like it is, not only is it not great communication, but it's not the way to honor what God is saying to us about being patient and kind. Instead, we ought to tell it like it could be, like maybe it should be. See, telling it like it is, all that does is reinforces any kind of negativity and any kind of labels that person might already feel. See, if I walk up to you and say, you're nothing but a screw up, you might sit back and go, you don't know the half of it. I've been a screw up all my life. I could tell you stories of how I screwed up that would blow you away. You don't have to tell me I'm a screw up. I already know. See, what good does it do for me to tell you you're a screw up? All it does is put a label and it reinforces any kind of negative feelings you might have. What if instead of telling it like it is, I tell it like it could be? What if I look at you and say, you know what? I believe God has a plan for your life. I believe you can be an incredible man or woman of God that God uses to make a difference. That empowers, that moves people forward. See, sometimes just the truth is not enough. Sometimes we need to be tactful and not just truthful. If love is going to be patient and kind, then we need to bring some tact to some of the truth that we speak to other people. He keeps going. He says, not only love is patient and kind, he says it, talking about love, he's going to tell us some things it's not. Love does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. It does not demand its own way. Do you have any of those people in your life that love to just one-up you on everything? You're telling a story and they just want to one-up it. You're telling someplace you've been, they want to one-up it, you know? You ever have any of those people and you're saying, no, I never have any of those people. It could be that you're that person. But that, you know, you're just telling, and there's a tendency to want to go toe-to-toe with them a little bit, right? You know, it's like, you know, I did this. Yeah, I did that twice last year. Okay, well, you know, hey, my family took a vacation over here. Yeah, I bought a vacation home there. Well, my dad can beat up your dad. You know, it's like, at some point, you know, you want to have your moment in the sun, but they just don't want to let that happen. They want to be, you know, they want to overshadow your moment in the sun. You ever have those people just one-up you? How do you respond to them? Because love is not supposed to be proud or arrogant or boastful. Love does not demand its own way. That's difficult with some of those people. But what if your level of understanding changed? See, if we're going to have this kind of love that Paul is talking about, then that means for us, a little principle it means for us is this. I need to be understanding and not demanding. I need to be understanding. See, what if in that person's life that you're struggling to love, that person is just draining your life? What if there was something about their life that you didn't know, but that maybe if you knew, it would change your perspective and maybe change your level of understanding? See, what if there's something in the background? See, any time that I'm looking at someone and I'm needing to have a better understanding of what's going on, and not just respond and not just be arrogant and demanding and boastful, but I need a level of understanding, then I can ask the three B's. And you can ask the three B's anytime that you need a different level of understanding. The three B's, their background, their battles, their burdens. What is their background? What did they bring into this situation? What has taken place in their life that you don't know about, but it's influencing the way they act today? What battles are they facing right now in their life? What health battles are they going through? What relational battles are they going through? What financial battles are they facing? What burdens are they carrying in their life? See, sometimes we're really good at seeing where a person should be and hasn't gotten there yet. You know, we're really good at going, well, you're a long ways off from where you need to be. But we're not as good about seeing where they've come from and how far they've come along the way. All we want to do is focus on the fact they're not there yet. But we don't know where they started. Sometimes if you knew a person's background, maybe their family and their upbringing, there was no model of kindness or patience. Maybe it was a dysfunctional situation. You don't know anything about that. Maybe they've come a lot farther than you even recognize. But sometimes if we knew a little bit of their background, if we knew what battles they were facing, if we knew what burdens they were carrying, it might change our perspective and it might change our level of understanding. So in those moments, we just want to be demanding. If we could just sit back and ask the three B's, maybe it would change our level of understanding so that we wouldn't be as demanding in those situations. He said, it can't be demanding. Can't be arrogant and boastful. He goes on, he says this. Verse 5. Love, it is not irritable, and it keeps no record of being wronged. Now see, that's hard. That's hard, right? Because some of the VDP, some of the sandpaper people in your life, are the people that have hurt you, the people that disappoint you over and over again. And the hurt runs deep. And so when we sit back and go, okay, love is not supposed to keep any records of wrong, that's difficult. Because when we've been hurt, our natural tendency and the way society kind of teaches is that we, you know, tend to go toward R&R. And I don't mean rest and recreation. I mean remember and retaliate. Right? That's our natural tendency. Somebody hurts us. Somebody does something wrong to us. First of all, we remember and we rehearse it over and over and over again. We remember every moment in that situation, everything they said, everything we said, everything we wish we would have said, the things we wish we would have done. We rehearse it over and over and over again. And remember, and we look for a moment we can bring it up. And retaliate. Use it as a weapon. See, some of you grew up in homes where your mom and dad were really good at this, right? So like your mom and dad would get into an argument. It was almost like your mom reached back into a filing cabinet of all these things and says, you know, I remember on June 1st, 1973, when you said this, and you're like, oh my gosh, mom, you could be a history teacher. How do you keep up with that kind of stuff? Right? But we all have a tendency to do that. Something happens, we file it away. I'll recall that when I need to. But if we're going to have a love that keeps no record of wrongs, it means we have to learn to forgive. And here's the principle we have to incorporate. I need to delete it and not repeat it. I need to delete it and not repeat it. See, instead of repeating it, and we do, we repeat what happened to us. We repeat the story. Over and over again, we repeat it in our minds. We repeat it emotionally, the way we felt. We repeat it to people. Let me tell you what happened to me. Let me tell you what he said. Let me tell you what she did. We repeat it to all kinds of people other than the person that actually did it to us. And other than repeating it to God, we repeat it to everybody else over and over and over again. Instead of repeating it, we need to delete it. We need to let it go and learn to forgive. Now, you know what the biggest hang-up we have about forgiving someone? If I forgive them, then I'm somehow letting them off the hook. I'm somehow condoning what they did, and I'm letting them off the hook. As if, and maybe this is a mental thing, I don't know, as if we have this big hook in them. That they're living their life going, I'm hooked somehow, I don't even know how, right? That hook that we feel like we have, that we've got to keep them accountable, that we've got to, you know, hold on to, that's only for us. And as long as we have that hook saying, I can't forgive because I don't want to condone, I can't let them off the hook, as long as we're holding on to that, then God doesn't have the freedom to heal our hearts. See, when we forgive, we're releasing that person from something that we feel like they owe us. And when we do that, it gives God the ability to come in and heal our heart. Forgiveness is more about for us as it is for that person. When I forgive, I'm giving God the freedom to work in my life. And forgiving doesn't necessarily mean that you immediately start trusting. That's a different deal altogether. You see, as a Christ follower, God has forgiven me for my sin, for all that I've done in the past, presently, and in the future. He's forgiven all of that. He's forgiven the fact that my sin put his son on the cross. That's a pretty big hook God's got into me. It's an eternal hook that God has into me, and he's forgiven. He has let Scott off this big old hook for eternity. And I look at God and say, thank you so much. Your grace is unbelievable. Your mercy, thank your forgiveness. Oh, my gosh, thank you so much. I'm not going to forgive you. You did that. You said this. You did this. I'm gonna keep that hook in you. You know what we're saying, right? We're saying by default that my sense of justice is better than God's. I mean, God was willing to let me off the hook for eternity, but I got a higher sense of justice than God. As a Christ follower, I have to forgive. And my forgiveness should be instantaneous. My forgiveness should be as quickly as God forgave me in Christ. But that's different than trust. I can forgive, but you know what? Trust needs to be earned over time. I don't just jump right back into that situation just because I said I'm willing to forgive. There's a difference there. But we have to learn to delete it and not continue to repeat it over and over and over again. He keeps going. Here's what he says next. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. Love does not take delight in hoping that whatever's happening to that VDP, that sandpaper person, that hopefully it's a bad thing that's going on. We don't delight when things come their way that are not good, but we rejoice in the truth. We celebrate the wins of their life. Why do I want to celebrate the wins of someone who's draining the life out of me? Well, if you see something positive in their life, that you would love to see them continue and repeat that again. The little principle is what gets celebrated gets repeated. If you want to see something repeated in someone's life, then celebrate that thing. And you know it's true for you. You know it's true for your kids. We tend to get on to our kids because of things they've done wrong, but if we ever celebrate them for the things that we want to see repeated in their life, they naturally want to have that celebration again. So we celebrate and they're like, I'm going to do that again. And when you do the same thing, people celebrate the things that you do. You want to continue to do that because we love the way that feels. What gets celebrated gets repeated. Celebrate the win. Celebrate the positive things you see in that person. It gets repeated because love doesn't keep a record of wrong, and love doesn't delight in evil, but it rejoices in the truth. And then Paul gets to the final verse in this little segment. And he does something that's different than the other verses. He does something that I think if you look at and you pull apart any one segment of this, you could possibly have an argument. But he puts it all together in one segment, and it's so powerful. And I'll try to illustrate it in just a moment. But here's what he says. Verse 7, love always protects. It always believes. It always hopes. It always perseveres. Now, you could look at this and go and pull out any segment of this, and you could probably build an argument against Paul. You know, I could go, okay, so love always believes. So that means I'm just supposed to be gullible. I'm just supposed to believe everything. Isn't that kind of like a codependent relationship where you say it, I just believe it, and you just keep doing it. I'm just believing. So we could build an argument. Love always hopes. Okay, I'm just supposed to hope. I hope for the best. Hope everything just works out. I'm just hoping. See, we could build an argument with any one of these things, but all together, Paul does something that's very, very powerful. And here's what I mean by this. In all of our relationships, we have a certain level of expectations that we bring into the relationship. There are certain things we expect from the people we're in a relationship with. It doesn't matter what that relationship is. It could be a marriage relationship. It could be a work relationship. It could be a friendship. It could be your neighbors. We have a certain level of expectation of things that they're going to do or not going to do. Also, in every relationship, there are behaviors that that person actually does or doesn't do. And oftentimes, in any relationship, there will exist a gap between what we expected and what they actually did. I expected you were going to do this, and you actually did this. I expected that you were going to be home at 4 because you said you were going to be home at 4. It's 4:30 and you're not here. I expected that you were going to do those chores because you said you were going to do those chores, but you didn't do the chores. And now there's a gap. You said you would never, ever do this again. And now I find out you've done this again. Expectations, behavior, the gap. I expected that you were going to have those reports done today because you told me you were going to have them done. And yet they're not done. There's a gap. And this happens over and over and over again in relationships. And these expectations are fueled by a lot of different things. Sometimes they're fueled just by what a person has said they will do or they promise they will do. You know, we stood at an altar together and you said you were going to do these things. You promised to do these things. And we looked at a contract together. You promised you were going to do these things. Said you were going to do them. You know, you said these things, maybe in just the mundane things of life, you promised you'd pick them up, you promised you'd be here. So a lot of times our expectations are based on what they've said or what they promised. Sometimes our expectations we bring in from our upbringing. Now, my daddy always fixed these things. You know, my mom, she always took care of this. And so we have these expectations that we bring into relationship. You know, my former boss, he used to do things like this, or she used to say it this way. You know, the neighbors we used to have, they used to do this. So we bring this sense of expectations to relationships. And when these expectations and behaviors don't meet up, there's a gap. And every time there is a gap between expectations and behavior, we make a choice to fill that gap with something. And we will either, and this happens every single time, a lot of times it happens just subconsciously, we're not even thinking about it, but every single time we will either believe the best or assume the worst. We do it all the time. In every relationship, whenever there is a gap, we are going to fill that gap with one or two things. We're either going to assume the worst or we're going to believe the best about that person in that relationship. We can believe the best and say, well, she's just running late. She's been really busy here lately. There's a lot of stuff going on. And so she's just, I mean, it's kind of been a frantic kind of time. She's just running a few minutes late. I'm sure she'll be here any moment. Believe the best. Or we could assume the worst. She never keeps track of time. She never looks at her clock. Guarantee she's on the phone with her sister again. She's probably FaceTiming or she's texting with her friends. Not keeping up with time. Assume the worst. Comes to money issues, believe the best. He's overspent again. You know, there's been a lot going on this month. There's a lot of bills that had to be paid, a lot of things, a lot of outgoing cash. There's a lot of things going on. I'm sure he has a great explanation. I know, you know, he said we weren't going to overspend again. I'm sure there's a great explanation for why that took place. Believe the best. We can assume the worst. He's a spender. His daddy was a spender. His granddaddy was a spender. They just spend, spend, spend. They can't keep a budget. They don't know what a budget looks like. We're going to be in the poorhouse someday because here. It's assume the worst. And we're constantly making these choices. We're constantly going back and forth. Either believing the best or assuming the worst. And what, where we go with this or where this happens, you know, which one we naturally choose, a lot of it depends on what we see. If I constantly see I have a certain expectation, I constantly see a certain behavior, then it begins to build in me of what I'm going to choose, either to believe the best or assume the worst. Sometimes it's based on our baggage, what we bring into relationships. maybe hurts, pains, regrets, maybe positive things that we bring. But it helps to determine a lot of times whether or not I'm going to believe the best or assume the worst. But we're constantly making the choice. In every relationship, when a gap exists, that we're either going to believe the best or assume the worst. And so when you look at what Paul is saying, and Paul is saying, love always protects, love always believes, love always hopes, love always perseveres. He's putting that together and saying, you know what? People that learn to love out loud are people that are by and large learning to choose to believe the best when there's a gap. Couples that are married for many years and they're still happy have made a habit to continue to choose to believe the best about their spouse. Friendships that have lasted for years because friends have chosen to believe the best. If we're ever going to try to love the VDPs in our life, it only comes as a result of believing the best. Now, I know what you're thinking. Some of you are sitting thinking right now, you know what, Scott? Why don't you put those dumb signs down? Let me come up there and tell my story. We'll see about believing the best once you hear my story and what happened to me. And you know what? In my line of work, I've heard about every sad story there is. And that's not to trivialize your story, because I know how real those things are. But I could probably come up with a story that would overshadow your story, just in what I've heard, what people have gone through. All I'm telling you is this. Out of all of those people, the ones that have shared all of their stories with me, the ones that continue to be friends, the ones that work through whatever grievances, whatever happened in their life, the ones that continue to be married, continue to be neighbors, continue to work in that place, are people that chose along the way to believe the best and not assume the worst. And they became generous in their explanations of what took place. They became generous when there was a gap. And I'm going to believe the best. I'm going to come up with all kinds of generous ways to believe the best about this person instead of letting my mind go to assume the worst. Where do you lean? Where do you naturally go when there's a gap in the relationship? Do you naturally go to a place of assuming the worst? Or do you naturally go to a place of believing the best? Where do you go in those relationships? There's a book. It's actually a management book, a business book. And it's by a guy named Marcus Buckingham, and it's called The One Thing You Need to Know. And it's a book about how they've looked at different businesses that are successful. And when they looked at these businesses, they were able to boil it down. The reason they were successful, they were able to boil down to the one thing you need to know. It's about focus. It's about, you know, honing in on this one thing. If we do this one thing, then we'll be successful. The one thing you need to know. And to back up the whole principle that it really boiled down to one thing, and then the businesses that weren't successful, they were trying to focus on all kinds of things. But those that had focused on just this one thing you need to know, they were the most successful. And to illustrate it, and to illustrate the principle and set it up, he references a study that was done on marriage. And this is what the study that was done on marriage, these researchers looked at couples that had been married at least 10 years and were still happily married. And the researchers, they assumed that they knew the reason why they were still happily married. They assumed that they had come up with the one thing they needed to know about these couples that caused them to still be happily married after 10 years. And the reason they thought they had that answer is because they knew and looked at another study in marriage where couples that were unhappy or actually had split apart, the reason, the one thing about those couples is that they didn't have any understanding of each other. They didn't understand what makes them, you know, what makes them tick. They didn't understand, you know, why they do certain things they do. They didn't understand anything about them. That lack of understanding kind of drove them apart and eventually split them up. And so because of that study, They assumed that these couples over here that are happily married and been together like that for 10 years, they assumed that the one thing we need to know is that they had a realistic understanding of each other. They realistically had a clear picture. This is who my spouse is. This is what he or she does well. This is what they don't do well. They had a clear, realistic picture. And then they got into the research, and they found just the opposite to be the case. That the couples that were married over 10 years and still happily married together, they didn't have a realistic picture of each other at all. In fact, they had a completely unrealistic picture of each other. Almost a delusional picture of each other. They did these testings where they would ask each person to sit down and go through a test and, you know, rate 1 to 5 or something like that of different feelings you had, different emotions, different things that you would do. Are you good at these things? Do you do them well, 1 to 5? And then they would have the spouse rate that person. And in every case, when the person rated themselves, they constantly rated themselves lower than their spouse did. Their spouse in every situation rated them higher than they were willing to rate themselves. So the person sitting here trying to have a realistic picture of themselves, and their spouse is going, no, it's so much better than that. It's so much better than that. It's so much better than that. Totally unrealistic, almost delusional picture of their spouse. And to the point where they finally concluded, love, I guess, is actually a little blind. And here's what they finally said. This was their main conclusion. Find the most generous explanation for each other's behavior, then believe it. That was the key to those marriages being happily married for 10 years plus. They would find the most generous explanation for that person's behavior, and then they chose to believe it. So, they'd sit back, you know, she's not just insensitive, she's just focused. It's not that he runs over people, he's just driven. They would try to be as generous as they could be in explaining their spouse's behavior. To the point where it was like, oh my gosh. But you know what? Some of you remember that when you were dating your spouse. See, some of you had people look at you and go, you don't need to be with that guy. I'm telling you, he's this and this and this. And you're like, hell, he's not that. He's this. He's not that. She is this and this. She's not that. She's that. And everybody around you was going, you are so blind. You are so blind to what's going on. You're so blind to that person. See, we know how that feels. We know what we've done. And maybe we were a little blind. But those couples that are happily married have chosen, I'm going to believe the best. I'm going to be generous in my explanation. And then I'm just going to choose to believe it. And see, if we're really ever going to try to love out loud or love the sandpaper people in our lives, or if we're going to try to be happily married for years, if we're going to try to have long-lasting friendships somewhere along the line, we're going to have to choose to believe the best about those people. Every time there's a gap, we'll have a choice to make. We can either assume the worst or believe the best. When we assume the worst, what we are truly doing is feeding negativity into that relationship, and it's eventually leading to the demise of that relationship. Can't help it. No relationship can exist in constant negativity and when a person's constantly assuming the worst about you. It just can't work. Can't exist. But every time we choose to believe the best, we breathe life and hope into the relationship. And it's not that we don't have hard conversations. It's not that we don't face true realities along the way. It's just that when there's a gap in what we expect and how they behave, we choose to be generous in our explanation of how we believe the best about that person. Let me ask you a question. How do you want people to view you? When there's a gap between what they expected and what you did, do you want them to believe the best about you? Or do you want them just to assume the worst? Here's what Jesus said in the book of Luke. Do to others as you would have them do to you. If you want them to believe the best about you, then why don't you start by believing the best about them? Now, quickly before we leave, underneath somebody's chair is a giveaway today, so you're going to have to reach beneath the chair and see if there's an envelope attached to your chair. And if it's not underneath your chair, right here. You've got it right here. Would you just stand up and just open that envelope? You don't have to come up here. Just open the envelope and then tell everybody what's inside. $100. All right. See, it really does pay to come to church, okay? Here's the deal. It's yours, and you can do exactly what you want to do with it. No strings attached, it's yours. I would encourage you, whoever's initials you wrote on the back of that sandpaper, I would just encourage you to find some way to invest into that relationship. Whether you do or don't, it's your money. And not like we're going to come and ask you next week, okay, what'd you do? It's yours. But I would encourage you, and I would encourage all of us, find ways to invest into that relationship instead of allowing it to constantly drain you. Are there ways that you can pour back into it? Are there ways that you can invest back into it? And see what God does with that. Because the truth is, if we want to live well, it's only going to come as we learn to love well. Let's pray together, okay? Father, thank you so much for loving us more than we ever deserve, for treating us better than we can ever imagine deserving, and for giving us an example of what it looks like to love well. God, some of these things, granted, they're not easy to do. If it was easy, we'd all be doing it all the time. We'd have a lot less trouble in the world. They're not easy to do. In fact, this kind of love is a supernatural kind of love that only you can give us and you can plant in our hearts. And I just pray that you would do that. I pray that you would infuse our hearts with that kind of love. And God, that you would just create a revolution of love, that we begin treating people so much better than they deserve. And we love them so much more than they could possibly imagine someone loving them. And God, as we do that, not only will we learn to live well, but God, I pray that you'd use us to make a difference in this world. Thank you so much for loving us and for showing us the way to love other people. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.